major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's Mardi Gras time. This week, we're traveling the state in search of the unique ways Louisiana celebrates. We'll go from Cajun country up to Shreveport. And of course, we'll visit where the party first got started, here in New Orleans. Carnival historian Errol Laborde examines its origins and gives us a glimpse into the private crew parties that take place before the riders mount their floats. Toby Rodriguez and Lucius Fontenot demystify the Cajun Courier de Mardi Gras, and wait till you hear what goes on in Shreveport. It's one big celebration on this week's Louisiana Eats. Carnival is not just about parades and parties. There are elements of sociology, religion, theology, and folklore behind every float, mask, and meal. Few people understand this better than Errol Laborde, author of Mardi Gras, Chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival. We sat down with Errol for a passionate discussion of carnival time and the history of Louisiana's most renowned cultural celebration.
There's a chapter that I did, one of my favorite chapters, and it's about the 1870s. And the significance of that decade was that was the year of the first Rex Parade. Now, by that time, there was already two parades in New Orleans. There was Comus and 12th Night Revelers. But Rex sort of really put Mardi Gras on the map in that it was the first day parade. And with Rex, you created this character who was the king of carnival. And with Rex, Mardi Gras in New Orleans really began to grow into a major event. The same year, Mobile, which already had a parading tradition, created a king of its carnival called King Felix. And Memphis started a carnival. And there were several towns that in 1872, out of the blue, were creating carnivals. Part of it, I realized, had to do with Reconstruction and the Civil War. It was a bit like after Katrina here, that there were people saying, hey, look, come back to our town. We're rebuilding. We're doing things. Here's something special to see. But also, I discovered, though, that there were some towns in Europe. For example, a town called Via Reggio. Via Reggio had an ancient carnival tradition, but in 1873, it reorganized its carnival and made it more of a marketable sort of thing. And in Nice, which isn't far from Via Reggio, just right up the coast and over the French border, they'd been celebrating carnival since the 1200s, but also in that same time period, they developed like the Nice Carnival Association. So all of a sudden you see, not just in the United States, but in Europe and other places, by the 1870s, creating, formalizing, really structuring a carnival. And the common denominator, because obviously the Civil War is not a factor over in Europe or Reconstruction, The common denominator is the railroad. Because by then, the passenger railroad is becoming unto its own. I mean, there have been railroads, but there's developing passenger railroad markets. And if you got a passenger railroad, you got to create destinations. And with the first Rex Parade, passenger railroads, you know, printed these flyers, and they had them in train stations up and down the line. Come to New Orleans and see the parade of the King of the Carnival. This was the era of the Industrial Revolution and steam power, and it was just part of that, that people were becoming more mobile, and there was ways for people to get around. And carnivals were a good way to mobilize people and give them something to come in and to discover.
And discover it they did. Since then, carnival has become a mainstay in Louisiana that's been celebrated by costumed revelers despite world wars, police strikes, and even the aftermath of that big weather event in 2005. Through it all, carnivals developed into a major economic engine in the state, due in part to Super Cruise, Bacchus, and Endymion, and the old line traditions of Proteus and Rex. It might be an understatement to call some of their food celebrations decadent.
There was a float group for one crew that for many years had its own party at Antoine's. Mm-hmm. And one of its objectives was to have a party that was as expensive as possible, right? And so this crew would get together in one room, and they would order for the group, you know, right off the oysters and the souffle potatoes and everything. They'd just serve, and they'd have wine, and they'd just dance. And they'd have dancing girls of various sorts, too. And then they would march. This was back when the parade was leaving from the auditorium. Mm-hmm. They'd have these guys with American Fire wagons, and they'd pull the wagons. The wagons had ice chests full of champagne. And they would march to the auditorium and get ready for the parade. So by the time that they got on their floats, they were fueled with an afternoon dinner at Antoine's plus champagne along the way.
Well, that's actually a pretty common tradition that a lot of the old line groups have luncheons before their big ride.
You know, at the carnival balls, it used to be a great tradition back when they were at the Municipal Auditorium that they'd have these huge parties backstage at the ball. Turtle soup was very common, and the mythology behind turtle soups, I mean, maybe it's true, was that turtle soup had a sobering effect. And so that was always something that you'd serve, and there'd be party sandwiches, and it was a big, big deal.
That turtle soup, it's always sobering when it's got that shot of sherry in it, huh?
Yeah, that always helps.
That makes good sense.
But then what happened under a previous city administration, they gave the food concession to some guy who just jacked up the prices tremendously, mm-hmm. and they made it mandatory that you had to get it from this guy. So the crew said, well, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And now you go backstage at the ball, and they may have, like, peanuts or something and some drinks. But more often what they'll do is that the crew will meet earlier that day, perhaps at a place like Galatoire's or Antoine's and Arno's. On Lundi Gras, there's the big Proteus lunch at Antoine's, and you walk by there, and it's such a juxtaposition. You see your Mardi Gras street people, and then you see your Proteus people, the Proteus ladies who are always dressed very nice, the Proteus guys who got the signature red tie.
Yes.
And they're just walking together. And, you know, it used to be that after the Proteus luncheon that quite often they'd go to another bar nearby. Mm-hmm. In the last few years, somebody at Antoine's got smart, and they put a bar count in front of Antoine's. And so they get them inside and outside now.
Errol, sometimes they throw food from the floats, don't they?
The law is, if you throw food, it has to be packaged. I mean, you can't just go and throw a hot dog or a piece of chicken or something like that. So throwing food is not really encouraged. But one thing that has become a tradition is moon pies. And that is not unique to New Orleans. That probably comes through Mobile because moon pies were developed out of Chattanooga. And so if there is one edible throw that you could kind of link with Mardi Gras, it's probably the moon pie. What I'm trying to advocate, and really getting nowhere with doing this, for watching the Rex Ball,
yes.
If you're at home, I think that the perfect supplement to have while watching it is moon pie and champagne.
Okay.
So I really urge people, while Rexing the Ball, have a couple of moon pies and have a glass of champagne and watch the Rex Ball with that, and can't ask for anything more.
I loved that you had an epilogue that you entitled Stir Me Something, Mister. Right. That's a great line. I really like that. And in that, first you list what you consider the 16 top foods of the Louisiana Mardi Gras. So I was hoping that we could chew that over together.
Okay, it was totally unscientific. It was me just kind of trying to figure this out. And keeping in mind, here I am talking about the Louisiana Mardi Gras, which is different from the New Orleans Mardi Gras. It's not the same kind of history or sociology or that sort of thing, but it's a parade. There are different destinations for the Cajun Mardi Gras. Different towns have their own celebration. There's subtle variations in between them, but they all borrow from what is called the begging tradition of carnivals. And this begging tradition is really ancient. It goes back to medieval Egypt, where peasants during a certain day of the year would go to the nearby castles. And they would essentially beg by putting on some sort of entertainment. The lords in the castle would give them a chicken or some food things. And the lords probably said, you know, this is probably better than the revolution, you know, so let's do this. So there is a long-established tradition of people going and begging for their supper, I mean, providing their entertainment. I guess perhaps our trick-or-treat kind of, developed in that spirit. And so look at the Louisiana Mardi Gras, which to me is a little bit different from the New Orleans Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. I had, first of all, barbecue. That's a big thing during Mardi Gras, especially on the parade route. And increasingly in New Orleans Mardi Gras on the St. Charles route. Boudin, okay. Uh-huh. Now, Boudin is not a real big New Orleans food. I mean, it's becoming more popular. But to me, it's a great parade food because it's contained. I mean, a good sausage, uh-huh. I mean, you can just hold it and you can just chomp into it, put a little mustard on it. And so I think at the other destinations around the state, that Boudin is a good parade food. Something else to put in, though, is cracklins, uh-huh. Which would also be a good party. I mean, anywhere where you're doing pork of any kind, especially if you're doing it from a boucherie, I mean, you got cracklins. And cracklins, you can also just bring a bag to the parade and eat it like potato chips, too. It's not what you call a health food.
Yeah, so, well, that's true.
Yeah, but I say like 3 or 4 cracklins a year is okay.
That's Errol Labord, author of Mardi Gras, Chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival. Look for Errol and his wife, Peggy Scott Labord, on Mardi Gras evening when WYES televises the Rex Ball and Meeting of the Courts. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Getting ready for the Mardi Gras. Getting ready for the Mardi Gras. Almost time for a carnival. Getting ready for the Mardi Gras. We gonna dance and have a ball. Getting ready for the Mardi Gras.
In sharp contrast to the elaborate parades and crews of New Orleans, Mardi Gras Day in Cajun country is altogether different. There are still costumes and great food, but it's like nothing you'll see in the city. Cultural correspondents Toby Rodriguez and Lucius Fontenot let us in on their Acadian traditions.
So out here in the prairies and the area outside of New Orleans, we have the Courier de Mardi Gras, which is a horseback Mardi Gras where people participate as opposed to watching parades. And the whole idea behind it is community. Once again, it's very important around here. Masked riders get up at dawn, gather together, and go out on horseback or walk and collect ingredients for a communal gumbo at the end of the day. And every neighbor that we stop at, as a show of appreciation for their donation to this gumbo, will either, you know, do some tricks or...
We cut some flips.
And it's just all this revelry. And I think something that people hear about is the chicken chasing part of it, which is always a fun thing. The farmer or neighbor will give you a live chicken and say, you're welcome to have this, but you must catch it first. And there's a dance at the end of the day with a gumbo, and everyone celebrates and has their last hurrah just before Lent.
We're fortunate that some of the older people in our immediate community that don't run anymore have taken on the obligation of cooking our gumbo. The thing is that, like, these revelers from this community go from door to door, go to the different voisins, the different neighbors, and receive donations for the gumbo. Mm-hmm. So the gumbo traditionally wouldn't have been started till after the Mardi Gras got back to that home position. But, you know, because there's like 500 hungry, drunk people that really need a bowl of gumbo.
That's a lot of gumbo.
That gumbo started early that morning by these older guys who have taken on that role. There's definitely a lot of community at that point. The major difference between New Orleans and the Cajun country Mardi Gras, which I love to go to Mardi Gras in New Orleans, but that's a spectator sport. And here, it's participation. There is no one, like, standing on side of the road watching us pass. Like, we are the parade. And the understanding behind Mardi Gras is that you have a day to be anonymous. You have a day to be something that you can't be the rest of the year. You get to be mischievous or canaille and get away with some things that, you know, sociably, maybe you couldn't get away with. You know, you get to act out of yourself. And I know for me personally, I become a really, really mean person Mardi Gras Day. And I would like to think that most people wouldn't think I was a mean guy most of the time. But on that day, I get to shed all that negative stuff.
And it's all behind a costume.
Costumes differ. Traditional costumes, the headpiece is a capuchon. There's a screen mask. You know, they're very multicolored. It's supposed to contrast. Mardi Gras is all about contrast. At that time of the year, you've got, you know, some nice silver gray skies. There's no leaves on the trees just yet. A lot of dead winter grass. So it's a very dull palette, and these costumes contrast that palette. They're very colorful. They're filled with fringes. The traditional costume designs are basically set to mock the authority figures. So you have the capuchon, which mocks royalty. You know, the old Duchess dunce-looking cap was worn by royalty, you know, in more, I guess, more pagan days, and that has actually been transferred over to us. And so you're mocking royalty in wearing that. But there's also, like, the bishop's mitre.
Yes.
Is pretty popular. And then there's the what the professor wears. That's another common. But you could also – you could mock just about anyone, you know. We've had – people dress up as presidents sometimes. The most important thing is that you have to know what that run is going to expect out of you. Some runs don't care about being completely disguised the entire time.
And the customs and the traditions of the run differ by neighborhood.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Give me some examples.
Let me see. What can I divulge?
Is it like a secret society too?
Well, it is some like things about those runs that are kept secret. You have to run it to experience it.
Uh-huh.
There are some runs that have an initiation, like a hazing that goes on before the run for new runners. There are some runs that don't allow women. There are some runs that are co-ed. There are some runs that are just strictly women. Some runs that have a traditional costume that is expected of you and that everyone wears that style costume, where other runs are a little bit more tolerable. They accept just about anything. If you run our run, I'd only have one bit of advice, and it's put on your mask.
Yes, indeed. You know, that's the law. Put your mask on.
Absolutely, and go ahead and dance with your id.
Alors, la Mardi Gras!
That was Toby Rodriguez and Lucius Fontenot, men who live out their cultural roots. Toby was raised in Poche Bridge, and Lucius grew up in Mamou, so food has always been a big part of their lives. They shared with us their insight into the often misunderstood foodways of Acadiana.
Food around here, it's just part of who you are. It's seen and every day it's celebrated.
I think to understand the food, the cuisine of a certain culture, the quickest way to that is to inquire about comfort food. Like, what's your comfort food? My father was extremely prejudiced towards his evening meal. It had to be rice and gravy. We all knew that. So, like, I grew up eating rice and gravy, like, every single night and probably during the day. I went to Cecilia High School. They had rice and gravy in the lunchroom. That was a given. So, you know, growing up on that, when I'm missing home or I'm having a bad day, I'm looking for a plate of rice and gravy.
The two of you all have been friends for 20 years, and you have watched and been part of the evolution of the Cajun food culture here. So y'all tell me, what are the biggest misconceptions? What do you think is the confusion that people have about the food culture here?
Well, I think the number one thing is people think Cajun food is really spicy in the sense of it's got a lot of pepper in it. More and more people have figured out it's more about actual spices and not pepperedness, but I think that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions.
Spices. So what spices are you talking about?
The use of the mirepoix, the holy trinity of onions, garlic, celery, bell pepper, just using a little bit of cayenne here and there, some paprika.
I would disagree on the paprika. Most of the time that I've seen paprika being used, it's a meat department trying to hide old meat. I don't know. I have somewhat of a stigma when it comes to paprika. I guess the popular culture version of what Cajun food is something that is too spicy, has too much heat to actually eat. It becomes a gimmick. It's totally not that at all. It's something that, you know, should have layers, evenly spiced. In each bite, there's a few different chapters that you go through to experience the entire book that is Cajun cooking. Another common misconception, which is an injustice to both us and New Orleans, is that people go to New Orleans expecting Cajun food. And that's not it. You know, that's not where you find Cajun food. If you want good Cajun food, you want authentic, genuine Cajun food, then yes, you have to come to, I would say, the Lafayette area.
Now, everybody knows that the Cajuns came from Nova Scotia.
Correct.
When we're talking this kind of food, are there any food influences?
That's another common misconception about our culture is that we do. I would not trace our food back to Acadie. I would trace our food back more to probably the butchering side, from like the meat preservation side. I think that our sausage and a lot of our butchering techniques are more German than anything. Spices, the more Caribbean, African, and Spanish. I'd go on record to say that I'm not a big fan of jambalaya. I think jambalaya is Cajun for dummies.
Really? Oh my goodness, I love that. Okay.
But if you dissect jambalaya, jambalaya is a Canary Islander or a Spanish person in Islano that moved into a neighborhood right next door to a German. No more saffron, but we got smoked sausage. There you go, jambalaya.
Well, I'm also really interested in hearing how there are two distinctly different methods of preservation. Everybody automatically goes to and thinks of smoked meat. But what's the deal with all that?
You see more of like tisale or saucisse de graisse, which would be either salt cured or confit. My grandmother used to make saucisse de graisse, which she was like, you know, calling it grease sausage, when in actuality she was performing this very traditional French gourmet application where she was confiting her sausage in grease. And all it was the crock, the ceramic crock that sat underneath the air conditioning window unit, that she'd go dig in and pull this link of fresh sausage that had been sitting in hog lard for weeks on end, and would fry that in a skillet, in a cast iron skillet, butterfly it, serve it on some fresh bread with some homemade hog lard mayonnaise.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm sure that heart issues are going to be in my near future.
Well, you know, it's all genes. That's a lot of it too, and maybe you got the genes. To
I got
take
a brand new.
Lard,
I got a brand new pair of jeans on right now.
Well, I was particularly fascinated that you told me you go from town to town and the food's different.
One of the easiest ways for me to tell where I'm at in Louisiana is how much liver is in the boudin.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, in Evangeline Parish, St. Landry Parish, there's a lot more liver in that boudin. It's a lot more bite. And the further south you get, you could just travel down I-49 and hit the little towns there. There's a little less liver the further south you go.
I think all our boudin started out that way. I can remember boudin as a kid across the board having much more liver. If you look at I-10 and I-49, the towns around those major highways, for some reason, the boudin Lafayette evolved into being this really meaty, really spicy, almost greasy boudin, which I love. I adore that boudin. And it almost said like it became a fad, and everyone developed their own version of that boudin in the Lafayette area. Brobridge has that boudin now. Scott has a whole bunch of that boudin. Opelousas has that boudin now. But when you go to the prairie, which is absolutely isolated, it's a geographical oddity. It's 45 minutes from anywhere you want to be at, like Mamou and Eunice, Iota. It's like old school boudin. It has a lot more liver in it, more rice, a little bit less spice, and probably a little bit more greens.
Well, I think we've barely been able to touch the tip of the iceberg about what's happening over here, what's important, what's going on. So will y'all come back and talk with us again?
Absolutely.
Next time we'll have to cook for you, though.
That's a deal.
Lucius Fontenot and Toby Rodriguez are Louisiana Eats Cajun cultural correspondents. With long days of Mardi Gras partying ahead, how can you be sure the food you're serving remains safe? Stay tuned, and when we come back, I'll share those important guidelines with you. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How can you be sure your food is safe to eat during the long days of Mardi Gras partying? Keep hot food hot and cold food cold. Hot means 140 degrees. Cold should be a minimum of 40 degrees. You've got about 2 hours at room temperature before bacteria begins to develop at risky levels, so only put out as much food as you expect your guests to consume within that 2 hour window. Then, replace it with fresh, because a tummy ache is never a good party favor. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Everyone's familiar with the ubiquitous New Orleans sandwich known as the Poor Boy. But have you ever experienced the delicious pleasure of a dirty boy? This clever sandwich is the invention of Chef Frank Brightston. He served it for a brief time at Charlie's Seafood, a Harahan institution where his ultimate childhood taste memories were created. Charlie's, named after its founder Charlie Petrosi, was Frank's neighborhood restaurant in the Harahan neighborhood he grew up in. Perched in a high chair, that's where Frank learned to peel his own boiled seafood. By 2009, the building was shuttered and emptied, so he and his wife Marna, who still live in Harahan, decided to resurrect the beloved neighborhood institution. Even though seafood dominated the menu, it was here that Frank introduced the world to a secret treat formerly reserved for the kitchen staff at Brightston's, his uptown white tablecloth restaurant. Frank called it the Dirty Boy. For 20 years, everyone from chef to dishwasher had snacked on the dark, rich combination of beef, pork, and liver, browned with the same seasonings you'd use in dirty rice, but without the rice. Instead, the meat mixture was stuffed into hot buttered pistolettes, which became a favorite staff meal. Unfortunately, Charlie's is once again just a memory, but that doesn't mean you can't cook up your own Dirty Boy. Officially, Frank never shared the recipe with me, so I've conjured up a very close, if not identical, facsimile that is a truly wonderful parade food. The Dirty Boys can be pre-made, wrapped in aluminum foil, and kept warm in the oven until you stick one or two in your pocket and take it out on the parade route for that moment when all the bead catching works you into a hungry frenzy. Try your own Dirty Boys by visiting our Louisiana Eats website at louisianaeatsradio.com or wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Frank Brightston's Dirty Boys are real Louisiana Eats.
I will steal a cricket bat, smash some windows, make a noise. We will run the Dirty Boys.
How do you spend Lundi Gras? Many New Orleanians catch the Proteus and Orpheus parades, while others attend all-night concerts at One-Eyed Jack's or Tipitina's. But if those experiences are too passive for you, then consider joining the Red Beans Parade, a walking parade with a single stipulation. Make a festive suit entirely out of red beans and rice. Founding member Devin Meyer is here to give us a behind-the-scenes look at all that red beans and rice fun. Devin, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us, how did this all get started?
Well, my fascination with beans began in Brazil. I lived there for a year and ate beans twice a day, every day, as is the Brazilian diet. And when I moved to New Orleans, I quickly realized that red beans and rice is a very important meal here, very important culinary tradition. And the first Halloween, I was trying to come up with a costume that I would make. And the idea just hit me one day that I would obviously take beans and rice and glue them to a suit and make a red bean suit. And I did that, and it went over pretty well. And then when Mardi Gras came around, it seemed like a great, reasonable idea to actually create a new cultural tradition here in New Orleans. So that's kind of how we got started.
How do you all actually go about making the suits?
Well, it usually begins with some object of clothing from a closet that you don't really wear, usually a suit jacket or a vest or some shorts. And we get out all the hot glue guns and the hot glue sticks. And I've got every type of bean imaginable. And we sit around and brainstorm. And most people decide upon some sort of pun or something for their suit. For example, we have a suit that is Benjamin Franklin. Houdini, the great magician, is another suit. Vanilla Rice was a suit last year. So people just use their creativity and they'll come up with something, or it could be just a design, like a map of the city of New Orleans in red beans and rice. And then people spend months meticulously beaning, which is hot gluing each individual bean, each grain of rice. And after about 5 months, you've got yourself a really elaborate costume.
Is everyone welcome to join?
Yeah, it's open to everyone. It does take months to make a good suit.
So it's too late for this year.
Right, it's too late for this year. But next year, right after Halloween is when we will begin. As soon as your Halloween costume is out the way, then we can really focus on your Mardi Gras costume. And if there's anyone out there that's interested, it is completely open to anyone in the city or out of town. And it's a pretty diverse group since it's open to anyone. We have a lot of just school teachers, a couple lawyers. We've got older people, younger people, children. So it's really diverse, which makes it just that much more enjoyable because New Orleans is such a great place for bringing multi-generational groups together and having an activity that everyone can partake in.
So what's changing?
Well, between you and me, I got a police permit, so I'm actually legal now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I feel great about that. So that's one change where we're growing up in a sense, and we're kind of jumping to that next level, going from something that literally began in my house with 8 people in a PowerPoint presentation and just a crazy idea. And now there's 60 people that are part of the organization, and it's growing. And I really hope to just make it a permanent fixture of New Orleans culture.
Do you all have a ball?
We do have a ball. We have decided on the tradition of not deciding upon our king and queen until just before the parade. So what we've done is created a wonderful party that's actually open to the public. At this party, we will roll out a rented red carpet, and every red bean suit that's been meticulously created will march or strut down that carpet and show off the suit to everybody that's there. And we will have voted on our king and queen. And also we have a princess of the parade, which is the most ridiculous person. And all that will be revealed in wonderful Mardi Gras fashion.
Is the princess always a woman?
No, and this is the really fun part of creating a new tradition. So the very first year when we had our election, one member, a good friend of mine named Robert, had made really short shorts and a vest, and he had no shirt on, and he had these cowboy boots, and he was just absolutely ridiculous. And when we got together and voted for king and queen, he actually got votes for both king and queen because people just... got a real kick out of the humor of his suit. And to give him a place of honor in our parade, we created Princess, which is just the most ridiculous person. And he also won it last year. We'll see if he wins it again this year.
I want to thank you and congratulate you on this new idea about how to use our iconic bean.
My pleasure. What more better thing to do in New Orleans than have yet another parade?
Devin Myers, bean eater and bean wearer, founder of the Red Bean Parade.
Got my red beans
When we come back, we'll travel to North Louisiana with Chris J. to hear how Mardi Gras is celebrated in Shreveport. You are not going to believe what they throw from the floats there. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Errol Laborde insists that hot food can't be thrown from a float, but our North Louisiana roving reporter says otherwise. Our Mardi Gras coverage continues with a brief report from Chris J. in Shreveport, where some of the largest parades roll right along the Red River. Don't count Caddo Parish out of the carnival celebration.
We got the Mardi Gras spirit up here too, and you know we're going to have a good time. We got a lot of parties coming up, a lot of parades. The three largest that are coming up are the Crew of Centaur, Crew of Gemini, and the Crew of Highland Parade. The Crew of Centaur and Crew of Gemini start in the early evening and roll into the night. These are the ones that people think of when they think of Mardi Gras and Shreveport-Bossier because they're enormous parades that roll all through downtown Shreveport and into the Broadmoor neighborhood.
How long is it going to take for the parade to pass by, for instance?
Well, I would say about 3.5 to 4 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, the Centaur and Gemini are both enormous parades. But most folks don't know about the smaller, funkier ones. The Crew of Highland Parade, Poppy, is one that I think you would really love.
Tell us about the Crew of Highland.
The Crew of Highland Parade is an afternoon parade, so it rolls around 2 p.m. on a Sunday, and it's more do-it-yourself, eclectic, marching organizations, and it's a parade with an unusual connection to food. And I say unusual, and I mean it. At the last Crew of Highland Parade I was at, some of the throws that I saw were grilled hot dogs thrown by the Crew of Barbecue. This gentleman grills and throws 9,000 hot dogs. Their float actually has smoking grills on it. He and his entire crew start at something like 2 in the morning, and they're grilling hot dogs, wrapping them in aluminum foil, and throwing them to people on the route. Those dogs are kind of revered in Shreveport, I would say. My wife has been known to chase the Crew of Barbecue float in the Crew of Highland Parade for 10 blocks just to get one of those hot dogs. But I've also had the following things thrown at me at the Crew of Highland Parade. I've been hit by a bag of spaghetti, which I still don't understand. I caught a Taco Supreme one time, which was really strange. The Crew of Highland Parade is just weird like that. You never know if you're going to be walking down the sidewalk and get beamed in the side of the head by a Ziploc bag full of spaghetti, which, honest to God, happened to me last year.
What are the iconic Mardi Gras parade foods? Are they barbecuing? Are they picnicking? What's happening?
I love that you bring that up. The beginning and end of the Crew of Centaur and Gemini parades, the ones that begin downtown and roll into the neighborhoods, people have staked out those areas, and they're grilling, and they're making big pots of gumbo. Lots and lots of grills will be smoking. But there in the middle, in that Shreve City area I mentioned, that's where you're going to find like mobile food vendors, food trucks. There's a wonderful new food truck up here called Po' Boys and Rich Girls, and they'll be set up, I'm sure, in that area. There's a great food truck called Some Like It Hot that I usually see in that Shreve City area.
Well, it sounds to me like the Shreveport Mardi Gras is a pretty delicious place to go.
It is, and this year especially, because for the first time in history, we're going to get our own locally brewed beer in cans that we can pack in our backpacks or our purses and enjoy along the route. It's a Great Raft Brewing from Shreveport. It's the first local beer since pre-Prohibition, and we're finally going to be able to drink it in cans. It's going to be in stores before the first big parade.
Well, I know how happy that makes you, Chris, and I want to say thank you so much, and have a happy Mardi Gras.
You too, Poppy, and I hope to bump into you somewhere along the route.
our Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Chris Jay. And you can learn more about North Louisiana's food scene and their Mardi Gras by visiting Chris at 20by49.com or by visiting us at LouisianaEatsRadio.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. With its colorful history and delectable taste, there's no food that gets to the heart of carnival season quite like king cake. Bakeries across Louisiana supply residents and revelers with king cake from Twelfth Night right on through Mardi Gras. Many have developed their own unique spin on the king cake tradition. One such bakery is Cake Cafe, located in New Orleans' Marigny neighborhood. Our engineer, Joe Schreiner, sent us this postcard.
My name is Steve Himmelfarb, owner of the New Orleans Cake Cafe and Bakery. We do a number of different king cakes. We do these mini king cakes, which I'm setting up right now. These are the apple goatees. We also do a raspberry cream cheese. Then we do this mini king cake for Aunt Sally's pralines. In the process of doing these mini king cakes, I mislabeled the Aunt Sally's apple goat cheese. So I have to write apple goat cheese really on ours so that when they go to be iced, they know, wait, these are apple goat cheese. That's the kind of thing that happens at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I got here about 1:45. It takes about a solid hour for the ovens to warm up, so that's a good time to get everything set up. We roll the doughs out the night ahead of time, so that when I come in, we have sheets of dough in the cooler that are ready to be worked with. So that's where these are right now. They're still pretty, they're kind of cold. So, but I'm gonna start making our raspberry cream cheese, large ones. We opened in 07, right at the beginning of September. So I've been making king cakes since before then. The first thing I ever really wanted to do was make sure it had the drizzle icing on it, because I really wanted to express the creativity and the boldness and the fun of Mardi Gras, and just really wanted it to be a piece of art. King cake is a real calling card for a bakery. And I really wanted to do something totally unique and something special that wasn't over the top. It was just real. There's the apple goat cheese, raspberry cream cheese. Those are the two biggest sellers by far. And then there's pecan with cream cheese and brown sugar and cream cheese and traditional. And it's really important to have a good traditional king cake, because you can't lose track of the tradition. You can't lose track of the foundation that it's built on. So I take the dough and twist it around a little bit so the filling will hopefully stay in, and we'll get ready and put these in the oven in a minute.
I'm Becky Himmelfarb, I'm Steve's wife, and I am right now mixing icing that I am going to use to decorate our king cakes. Before you put icing on anything, you have to work the icing. It's been refrigerated, so when Steve comes in, he takes it out so that it can be at room temperature when I get here. And then I can put it in the mixer and work it, which is much easier than when I used to work it by hand. So I guess, not everything about the Industrial Revolution was bad. Although the mixer's been one of the few things that made me say that. This is our green. As you can see, it's a very bright, I call this Mardi Gras green. I don't have the baking background my husband has, I just have the New Orleans background. So I draw on my childhood, and I look at that and say, yes, Mardi Gras green, that one's ready to go.
Hey, Cheryl, can you ask Steve if he has any tickets?
These are the finished cakes that have come out of the oven, and you can see they have some extra flour on the top. So then I just brush that off. Take it off. The ends are always where it sticks the most, but you have to work your way around and then move it onto the board. Oh, I don't like this board. It's a little messed up. We'll just recycle that. You know, these are special. You don't want to treat them that way. The details count. So I'm just putting a little tiny bit of stuff in here that will help the icing set. Because, you know, you're looking at it and you see purple, green, and gold, and it looks like three different things, but actually it's all the same icing, so there's no reason for it not to all run together. So I'm going through and I'm laying the icing on the cake. I'm doing the purple first. Those were a little skinny, so I'm just going back over them. This is a little bit thick. I'm probably going to thin it out a little bit. We try to get all the way around with spoonful if possible.
Mardi Gras music on.
I know.
We listen to Mardi Gras music every morning when we do our
cooking. Yeah. Shuffle. Okay, and here's my mix. We usually start with Louis Armstrong. You know what? The only other thing really for me to tell you about is the babies. We have our bucket of babies. We open that, and that has all the babies in it. Traditionally, the baby used to be baked into the king cake. Tourism became a much bigger business in New Orleans. So by the early 90s, you had tourists regularly eating king cake. In New Orleans, a five-year-old would know to look for the baby, but adult tourists were choking on babies. So most people stopped putting them in. We like to put it on top. We put it right there in the crevasse. Where the ends meet after we have it all decorated. And then we tell people, you know, if you want to put it inside, follow the tradition, which we like to do. You just lift up one little spot and stick it in underneath. The cake is soft enough, you're going to be able to stick it right in.
Boy, grab your coat, grab your hat. Leave worries on your step. Just direct your feet on Sunday's side of the street. Can't you hear that pitter-pat? Yes, happy tune, your step, baby. Life can be so sweet on Sunday's side of the street. I just walked in.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, Adrian Miller talks soul food.
I think of soul food as being more intense than Southern food, and a limited repertoire of Southern food. So to me, there's a stronger emphasis on variety meats, so the neck bones, the oxtails, chitlins, that kind of thing. I think there's more intense flavoring, so I think soul food tends to be spicier.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and consulting producer and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.